Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, we're pleased to have with us again Lauren Groff, who last appeared on our show to talk about her novel Arcadia back in 2013. I think personally, we had a great time. I had a great time. Lauren's first novel was The Monsters of Templeton, and then there is her collection of short stories, Delicate Edible Birds, and the previously mentioned Arcadia. Today, we're going to be talking about her latest novel, Fates and Furies. Her work has also appeared in, like, The New Yorker, Harper's, The Atlantic. She's won tons of awards, but Fates and Furies has been shortlisted for the National Book Award for Fiction, so that's maybe the biggest. And the winners, I think, will be announced after this broadcast on November 18th. But she's also won, just to show how good she is, the Paul Bowles Award, the Medici Book Award, the O. Henry Award, the Pushcart Prize, shortlisted for the Orange Prize, and finalist for the LA Times Book Prize, amongst others. So anyway, Fates and Furies is a novel about marriage, but more than that, it's a novel about good and evil, choice, regret, and perhaps most poignantly for many, or all of us, how what happens to us when we are very little affects us for our entire life, and in fact, balloons as we grow until what might have been just the tiniest little thingy grows larger. It fades, but it's ever present. Like if you took a Sharpie and drew a heart or a skull and crossbones on an uninflated balloon and then blew it up. The bigger the balloon gets, the bigger the image gets, but it fades too. So you either live with it one way or another, and if you are truly enlightened, I guess you just pop it with a pin and be done with it, but I've only met like five or six people in my life who can do that. So anyway, with that ponderous and self-indulgent introduction, hi Lauren, it's great to see you again.
Hi, it was great to speak with you too, and that was not ponderous or self-indulgent.
So was it weird to be long-listed for the prize with your agent, Bill Clegg?
Yeah, it was a little weird. It was.
Because as I mentioned earlier when we were talking before, I interviewed him a couple weeks ago for Have You Ever Had a Family? We talked a little bit about you, actually. And it's funny because, you know, he's like almost a boutique agent, but a really great one. And of his authors, I've interviewed the book The Unfortunates, The Wonder Garden, We Are Not Ourselves, Family Life, The Un-Americans. Isn't that amazing?
That is amazing. No, he's a phenomenal agent and a really, really kind person and a dear friend. So,
he seemed like a wonderful person.
He is a wonderful person.
So by the way, that thing that your characters do on the fort in St. Augustine, I did that too.
No, you didn't. Oh my God, that's so scary.
Okay. Now everyone's going to read it and know what I'm like.
I know.
And I drove to Crescent Beach every weekend for years and then drove on the beach, which I found actually blasphemous, but I did.
Right, exactly. I don't understand, but it looks really fun.
It is, but it's like the sand turns oily and all, and it just seems so bike week, Daytona Beach kind of thingy.
It makes me sad, because that's a habitat where sea turtles come up and lay their eggs. I mean, it seems really wrong.
I know. They have those signs there and the dunes and all that. But I that's when I was going to college at the University of Florida, and I was like 19, 20, 21. We had a blast. It was fun.
Ha, ha, ha. Very funny.
So anyway, your novel is bracketed. Why?
There are parts of it that are bracketed, yeah. For many, many, many reasons. One is this book is about performance in certain ways, right? And that marriage is not only this intimate, very tender space between two people, but it's also somewhat performative as a phenomenon, right? I mean, you do it for other people also. As I was thinking about that, I realized that Lotto is not only an actor, he's a playwright at a certain point, the husband in this marriage. And then it made a lot of sense for me to have these moments where there are somewhat aside-like brackets where people sort of, I won't tell you what people swoop in and out, sort of commenting in a meta way upon the book or what's happening at hand, the scene at hand.
Well, it's hard to talk about the book. A lot of this is hard to talk about because there's so many spoilers, and I always try to avoid spoilers.
I know. I'm with you. I know. I've been sort of talking my way in circles around the book for the past month. So.
Well, has anyone kind of spilled the beans in any of the reviews?
Everybody, yes. Everybody has.
Yeah, I know, and I could see. I mean, I could. It's well, it's like the okay. Bracketing is a device, and also. Kind of like, is marriage then a device? That's maybe your ambivalence. I mean, the bracketing is a device, and it wasn't until the very end of the book that I kind of realized who was talking at any specific time. Then I realized it.
Right. But, oh, good. I'm glad you did.
Yeah, but see, if I talk about why I realized it, then I'm giving away stuff. So
right, exactly.
Make it difficult, Lauren. So anyway, it is a device, so then I'm just thinking in my head now, does that mean that's where your ambivalence springs from, because marriage, too, in itself is a device?
It absolutely is a device. And actually, when I think about the book and when I'm trying to explain the book in sort of an elevator pitchy sort of way, I like to think of it as, you know, the marriage in this book is like a bomb casing. You know, it contains what the book is, but it's not what the book is, right? It's there's so much more explosive matter on the inside.
That's what I said in my introduction.
What interruption?
I mean, my introduction. I said it's a book about marriage, but it's not really a book about marriage.
Right. It is, but it isn't. Exactly. And our lives, you know, if you or anyone is married, I mean, it's a big part of your life, and it contains a lot, but it's not what your life is about.
Well, it's so funny because also what I said about things that happen at the very beginning. And I mean, I can think back to my own life, and there's things that happened to the beginning I'm not even sure really even happened.
Yes.
But I know they were formative.
Exactly.
You know, years of therapy, and I still don't know what it was. But something, you know? It's something. And
does it matter? Does it matter that you
Well, that's why I said you could pop the balloon, and just like Chung Yam Trungpa and Shambhala meditation, the idea is you have to let go. But there was something formative with Lotto, too, with his father.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, we've gone too far without me saying the thing I never say, which is, tell us a little bit about your book, Lauren.
Oh, okay. All right. Sure. My book is about Lotto and Mathilde. They have been married, and they will be married in the book for 24 years. And Lotto is this, I try to write sort of a personification of Florida. So he's this big, loud, hot, you know, sunny person with a lot of weird stuff happening on the inside. And Mathilde is to all initial visions his perfect and loving wife. And the love between them is really, really real, because one of the things that I was trying to think about when I was writing this book is how many works of literature or, you know, books there are in the world where the marriage is a happy one. And there are very, very few of them. And so with this book in particular, I wanted to think about a happy marriage without necessarily having happy people in it. And I wanted to think a lot about privilege and creativity and time, because time is almost its own character in this book, and storytelling. I mean, these are all lots of things that that came up while I was writing.
What the hell is it about Florida? I mean, it's not like writing about California that's kind of cool. And when I was talking to, I forgot her name, who wrote Swamplandia? Karen Russell.
Karen Russell.
Yeah, I was talking to her because it reminded me a little bit of that in the beginning, especially with Wikiwachi and the mermaids and all.
Yeah, right.
And what is it? It's like creepy but not creepy. And then there's the Carl Hyacinth thing, and then there's swamps. And what is it anyway? Because I lived there for 29 years.
I
don't know what it is.
It's fundamentally not meant for human beings. I think that's what it is. I mean, it's an incredibly perilous place that before the advent of air conditioning was for things that really wanted to kill you. Everything wants to kill you here, right? I mean, there are alligators, amoebas that swim through your ear canal and start eating your brain. Even the foliage wants to kill you. The saw pimentos, they're sharp.
Yep.
You know, everything wants to kill you here. So, you know, it's incredibly beautiful. This is a stunningly, naturally gorgeous state that human beings have sort of fallen into and changed to be less beautiful, and have sort of tamed in a somewhat sad way. So I think it's just a fascinating state, right? And so much weirdness from in America comes from Florida. Marco Rubio, right, comes from Florida. Am I allowed to say that? You can cut that if you
yeah,
want.
No, I feel the same way about Marco Rubio as you do, and about Donald Trump, and about Dr.
Donald
Carson,
Trump.
And, you know, it's just, it's like a circus. But that circus is America.
That circus is America, but that's what I'm saying. Like, the things that start here sort of reverberate larger in America. It's just odd. And I don't know if you saw Versailles. There's the Queen of Versailles. It's this wonderful
yes,
movie.
Yes, I saw it.
Yes. And that's near Orlando, this enormous, sad, developing house. It's the biggest house, you know, on the planet, I think.
But that's what Donald Trump is going to be when he'll probably tear down the White House and put, yeah, he'll probably put, say, Trump House on it.
Oh, if he gets elected, I mean, we're all done for.
I don't know. George Bush got elected and we were all done for. Arnold Schwarzenegger got elected. Jesse Ventura, for God's sakes, 2 terms in Minnesota.
He's actually pretty good.
I love him.
Right?
His conspiracy stuff is right exactly with mine. Seriously. Yeah, I can't even imagine Ponce de Leon when he comes looking for the Fountain of Gold. I would just give up. Who wants to hack their way?
I know.
I can't even imagine it.
I know. And they lost so many people, and oh, it was just a massive disaster.
Well, we've gotten a little off track,
I think.
So with regard to, Hamlin. There is no Hamlin. Hamlin is a development in Winter Park. So how'd you come up with Hamlin, Florida?
Oh, because in an early draft, Lotto's family came from oranges. Their money came from oranges, and Hamlin is a kind of orange. That's it. And then I liked it because it's like Hamlet. Right?
We got to talk about that too. But Hamlin is also in Winter Park now. It's a new development. It's kind of ritzy.
I did not know that. Well, yeah. I guess they were looking up orange varietals also.
Yeah, I bet you they were. And then all those oranges are gone now. When I was first there, they were all the groves were there.
That's the saddest. I mean, there are many sad things, but, you know, I don't know if you read John McPhee's amazing book, Oranges, about orange juice, the sort of concentrates.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Oh, so incredible. So good.
Said Hamlet. So what's the deal with the father? I mean, Lotto's father being Gawain, like Sir Gawain, the Green Knight, and then Lotto is really Lancelot, although Sally just says, no way, we're going to do that. And then you have Roland and what? So names and Antoinette and Mathilde. So you thought a lot about names here. And Charlie and Mava. I mean, you thought a lot about names here.
Yeah, I did. I love naming. It's fun. I mean, a name is a micro-narrative, right? And particularly with the knight names, I was just having fun with the idea of the courtly romance, right? Because the first part of the book in particular is fascinated by old forms of narrative storytelling. And it takes a lot out of, say, for instance, the Kunstleroman, the development of a point of view character or as into an artist, right? But there are also, you know, there's the idea of the traditional Greek idea of the tragic hero, which Lotto may or may not be and may or may not believe himself to be, right? The first part of the book I intentionally wrote using all sorts of different narrative techniques in order to talk about narrative and the ideas contingent to narrative, and so that in the second part of the book, and I don't want to give away too much, but there's sort of a puncturing of that idea.
Yeah, and it's funny too because, well, let's see, I can think of lots of examples, but one good one is like when Mathilde starts writing, and she writes this play that has three stock Greek characters that comprise a standard Greek play, and you even say in a very unsubtle way.
Right.
And I'm thinking, you know, and I know what each of those characters are and I know what they stand for. So you can't talk about this book because you give everything away.
I know. See, that's the problem. I know. Believe me, I've been trying so hard for a long time to talk about this book.
But then you have Antigone, and you have all these Greek plays and devices and theater brought into the future. No, brought into the present. And I wonder, there must have been so many things going on in your head because there's a lot going on in the book.
There's a lot going on in the book, but of course, remember, I wrote it over the course of 5 years. And the way that I write is dependent on certain layers of new knowledge coming in at different points. So I still write longhand, and I write lots of relatively quick drafts in the beginning in order to sort of figure out where I'm going and what my characters are and what the structure is and all those sort of larger foundational structural choices that you have to make. Now, and then only after, you know, years and probably 8 to 15 drafts like that will I settle down and do the language bit, which is just as important, but, you know, I don't want to worry about that when the foundation is wonky. So and what happens when you do draft after draft after draft like that is just, it's almost like you can see those sedimentary layers of different obsessions coming into the book at different times.
That's so funny about the drafts. I was just thinking, like, if you were Mathilde, and then when you're, like, 78, and, like, Roland steals the draft, I was thinking all your drafts will be worth a fortune. So you're
kidding. No, I throw them out.
What?
Yeah.
Really?
I don't want them around. It's bad negative energy. Like, psychic.
Well,
psychic,
did you save them for your kids? Because then they can sell them. It'd be like an annuity.
Oh, well, maybe.
Once you win the award and all that? Jeez.
Who knows? God. Who knows? I'm writing for now. Now is the important
the moment. Well, so here's a list. Okay, you don't even have to answer this one because it would be such an incredible spoiler, but I'm not going to spoil it. But what's the difference whether a foot or a toe is involved as opposed to not, because both are equally, you know, mens rea kind of thing. They equally beforehand thought out, correct?
A foot or a toe?
I'm trying to be as obtuse and obscure. I'm just talking to you like I'm talking to you. I'm trying to be as opaque as possible. So if you don't get it.
Wait, I guess I don't know what you're referring
because
to.
Because I can't refer to it because it gives the whole book away.
Oh, shoot. I'm
like,
sorry.
Okay, if you're talking, if suppose you were talking about, let's just suppose you were talking about a staircase.
Okay.
And whether a toe or a cousin. God.
I guess this is so elliptical that even I don't understand.
Well,
it.
I'm trying to be. I'm not. Do you want me to say it? I'll say the whole thing.
Say it and then cut it out of the. Yes.
No, I'll do it. I can't do that. I'll do it at the end.
Okay.
okay, so what I'm saying is, here, let's put it in a way that's, you know, kind of rhetorical. So if a person does start out doing something that they shouldn't do or feels like they shouldn't do, and if it's actually something they really shouldn't have done, is that, I mean, that's one of the, you know, you're coming at this book obviously from two points, and there's no reason why I can't say that the first half is about one person, the second half is about another person told from some perspective. But is it true that both of them, in your mind, metamorphosize, change, grow, evolve from singular incidents that occurred early in their lives? Is that a really...
I see what you're saying.
No,
okay. Sorry. There were so many staircases in this book.
Oh, yeah. Well, why are they pulling up this stairway instead of a regular jetway? Because it's a little airport?
Because it was a very small prop plane. That's why.
No one knows what the hell we're talking about.
I know. It does matter. What matters is intention, right? And when we make our decisions in life, and if our intention was benign or malignant, and because whatever the case, you can't have any control over the effects of our actions in our lives, right? So the moment when we make our decisions, that's when that's when it matters, whether or not we intend to do something good or we intend to do something bad.
But if a four-year-old lets something happen,
right, exactly,
as opposed to a four-year-old being causative.
So about that, and I don't want to give away the book, but there's an idea that you can punish yourself and for things that you may or may not have chosen to do. And it doesn't necessarily matter if this is something that you choose to do, because both possibilities can live in your brain. And two stories can unroll at the same time simultaneously, right? There can be the story of, I chose to do this bad thing, and then I couldn't possibly have chosen to do this bad thing. And both of them have equal weights, and both of them can change your life simultaneously. So I find it so interesting, the idea that we've been given by drama, you know, and narratives that we see a lot, that there's cause and effect, right? There's something that happens and then something comes out of that. When in reality, cause and effect is one of those things that are imposed retrogressively, you know, like in retrospect. And we only know the effect of things when you're looking back on things.
You know,
but the truth is, you know, you really can read any situation, even contradictory to itself, right? Just because one seems so apparent at one moment doesn't mean that it's going to be completely apparent later. So we all have multiple versions of any story going on within our lives themselves, whereas in narrative, that's not necessarily the truth. In narrative, we simplify unnecessarily.
See, look, it's good. I think this is a good interview because I'm really not asking you questions, but your answers really explain the book. I mean, that was a good answer explaining the whole book because, you know, there's one person that lives two ways. And that's why at the end I was kind of pissed off because, you know, Charlie is such a disgustingly horrible person. I figure, why should she go ahead and do the whole thing, you know? Just do the whole thing. You think is she making up for everything by putting it in the sink?
Because I think she's not sure if she's a good person or not.
Right.
And I think she, my read of her is she actually is a good person who has made horrible decisions in her life, but she's done so with clarity and the ability to sort of sense where they're going to go. Right, and maybe these aren't decisions that we ourselves would make, but she is a survivor, right? She does not succumb. And so that moment of mercy shows me who she is, I think she's a good person.
She's a fascinating person and a perhaps beautiful person, and he's perhaps a compellingly handsome person, but he's not. That's what's also interesting, too, is depending on which character is talking, of their shallow, insouciant, sycophantic friends who are mean and cruel to them, depending on which one's talking, she's either the most beautiful thing in the world or she's plain as a piece of cardboard. Isn't that interesting? You do that?
Yeah, but we do that in life, right?
I guess so.
Right? There's no consensus.
I don't know if she's beautiful. In the movie, which there will be, do not get Ben Affleck to play him, please.
Don't worry.
Please. And the other thing is, the only actor tall enough in Hollywood to do it is the Wedding Crashers guy. What's his name?
Vince Vaughn?
Yeah, he's 6 foot.
Oh,
he's
no.
The tallest actor.
He would not be good.
Yeah, I know. It'd be horrible, but he's 6 foot six. You got to so you can't get Tom Cruise or anyone. You know.
Oh, God, no. No. Maybe we need just a super talented new person.
No, it'll be Benedict Cumberbatch. He'd be perfect.
Oh, he's so good. Oh, he's perfect. You're right.
But I can't think. The only one for Matilda would be like a very young Uma Thurman, in my opinion.
Well, actually, I think there's this wonderful actress, and I can't remember her name at the moment, but she's 6'3", and she was in The Great Gatsby as sort of the flapper.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And she's a stunning theater actress. I mean, she's really, really good. She would be very excellent. And she was born in Paris, and I think she speaks French, too, which is...
Do you speak French?
I do.
Okay.
Yeah, I spent a year in Nantes.
What about the restaurant she goes to in Paris? And it's not very good food, but it's the place to go. And I've forgotten the name of the restaurant.
La Closerie de Lilas.
Yes. I suppose you've eaten there?
I have. After the Paris Marathon, which was my first marathon, I took my husband, and it was the best food ever, just because I'd run 26 miles. But
did you run it with your sister?
No, I didn't run it with my sister. No, she's never done a marathon, I think.
She just does. Really?
Yeah. Well, my sister, so just to explain things, my sister is a professional triathlete. She was in the London Olympics and got fourth, and she's going to Rio next year, too.
Yeah, I read.
So she's a spectacular athlete. But no, they don't do marathons because she does Olympic distance triathlon, which is not Ironman distance.
Oh, yeah, right. I forgot about that.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, I keep taking... Okay, so anyway, Charlie, do you think that what she's doing there in the sink, do you think that Charlie's going to be a good influence on you-know-who?
I do.
You do?
I do. I think they will be... He may not be a good influence, but you-know-who will have someone in their life that is like Charlie, and I think that will be an important thing.
Okay, this is weird, and I know it sounds weird, but this is the part of the interview where I said something that spoiled the entire book, and the author made me remove it.
Oh, you can't say that. You just spoiled things.
I didn't spoil anything. I didn't say anything about anybody. I'm running down the time. If you don't want me to, I'll cut it out, but I didn't say anything.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, that would be a possibility, right?
Nope.
I thought that would be kind of... All right, I'll take it out, I promise.
Okay, no, it's good.
But, you know, you do make it difficult.
I'm sorry.
It's all right. So what about their friends? I mean, and what about the fact that if Mathilde saw Lotto with Charlie, wouldn't she have second thoughts about, do I really want to be with somebody whose best friend is kind of a creep?
No, what she loves in him is this sort of... the lack of judgment, right? The fact that he accepts everyone and he takes them for who they are. And yes, it comes out of a sense of deep narcissism, but Lotto's a generous person. And sometimes we don't really think about the motivations for the generosity that compels us so much. And Lotto's motivations may not be pure, but he's still... He's a love, and yeah, and Charlie is not totally repugnant. Charlie is a truth teller, and it's always good to have one truth teller in the bunch, even though sometimes what they say is not kind.
Even though they stab people in the back?
Yeah, sometimes.
So what's the difference in marriage if someone says, will you marry me? You can say no, yes, or sure, if all three are the same answers.
Sure is sort of jokey, but it's also sure, right? There's certainty in it. So you can read it in any way that you want to read it. And yes and no are so absolute, right? Sure is like this open wonderland where there are many, many different readings that could come out of that word.
It's funny, though, because you do make a point of letting... You make a point of making sure that the reader knows that all three are there.
Right, right.
You definitely do that. Are you saying the reader can just run with it?
Right, exactly.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting how Lotto steals the leech story, too.
We all do that when we write things. And even, in a partnership, you start stealing the other person's stories and... One day you'll start telling that story, they get so many laughs, and look across the table and say, oops. I've done that to my poor husband multiple times. He does not like it.
Well, he might not like it, but if he likes it, it's kind of like, that's the whole thing about a marriage. It's like, what did someone just say? It's just all it is a very long conversation. Or did you say it? Or did you say it?
Right.
Did you say it in your book, or did I just?
That was in my book.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That's actually the Italian title.
Right. Right.
A very long conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, and so that conversation is like ours today. I mean, it's like, yeah.
But longer.
Yes, much longer. Well, I've been through two of those conversations.
So. Oh, have you really? Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and they were both very different conversations.
Huh.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at both of them, actually. Well, so when Lotto is reading the reviews of his plays, and there's one particular person who doesn't review his plays very kindly, and then Matilda, she's want to do, is able to rectify things. So did that remind you, or did you, I hate this word, but were you informed by your own reviews of books of yours? Did you think about that at all, or that was, two things are totally separate?
So only in the beginning, because I've stopped reading reviews unless they make my husband cry. He's my filter. and so in the beginning, I would get just furious by blatant misreadings, right? I mean, the idea that the reviewer wasn't adhering to the really kind reviewing guidelines set forth by John Updike, which are great. That really, really used to bug me. But now it's part of my job, and I either had to turn them off or get much, much tougher. And the problem with getting tougher if you're a fiction writer is that you stop being vulnerable to the things that make you write fiction to begin with. So I'd rather be like this tender hermit than to be this calloused, tough person able to take criticism easily.
Yeah, because I read all the reviews. There's one review of your book that kind of stands out as doing a little bit of that, what that woman does to Lotto. Just one.
Okay. Well, thanks for telling me.
It doesn't say. It says it's great, but it just says a couple of things. That's all.
That's hilarious. Yeah. No. And you can't control. This is the hardest thing for a control freak like me, right? You cannot control how other people will read your books, and sometimes that's horrible. But other times it's gleefully wonderful, right? So. This past summer, I had a story in The New Yorker, and and I thought it was really straightforward, the story. And then this woman from, I think, South Florida wrote me, and she's like, I figured out your story. This is what it is. And she listed all the characters and gave them sort of attributes of the seven deadly sins, which was not at all in any way in my conception of the story, in the creation of the story, in the story itself, in my view, but she has an absolute right to say that, and it's her story now, and if she finds that, that's so wonderful, and it just pleases me to no end that she found that in it, you know what I mean? I think it's just glorious.
Well, that's why it's like our book clubs at the... and there's no, I think we talked about this last time, there's no guys in any of my book clubs, and we have like six or seven of them. But the women, you can get to a point, and your book will probably be the same way, and it'll be one of our book club selections.
Thanks.
It's, you're welcome. It's, they'll be, going across the table, throttling each other because they're going to have different interpretations of Matilda for sure. And Lotto for sure too. Because some people are going to say, oh, what a wonderful person, what a spineless, some people are going to say that he's, and how can he let himself be manipulated this way? And some people are going to say, it's so wonderful that he's so open and lets everybody in, like you said, and is so kind and gallant. Gallant.
Yeah. Right.
That's why he has that name. Forgot.
Right, exactly.
And then the same with Matilde. It's, what a wonderful person. It's so nice that she guides and she's able to, without interrupting the flow of his life, still give the flow of his life. And other people are going to say, oh, she's a, she did that too.
And tell them that both of those reads are equally valid and absolutely true.
I guess that's what I was looking for from you.
Yeah, no, totally right. I did it on purpose.
I like that. I did it on purpose. So this woman yesterday was telling me, I told my husband to get a bid for doing a brick sidewalk. And he came back and he gave me a bid for doing a flagstone sidewalk. And I said, so what's wrong with flagstone? She goes, I don't know. But the point was, she told him to get brick and he didn't get brick.
That's hilarious. That's so funny.
Well, so I think last time we talked about Arcadia, which has a little more, I don't know, not open-endedness to it. But we talked about post-apocalyptic stuff too.
We did.
And this is so no magical realism stuff like that at all, except it does kind of float. You know what I mean? It kind of float. The reality in this book kind of floats. I'm not saying it right. You know what I mean?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Right. Exactly. Right. There. Well, you can read it in multiple ways. Right. It's not one single narrative. It's multiple or it's like a narrative cloud.
Right? There you go.
Or it's a narrative building in which you can choose your own pathway from one end to the other.
Hey, what about Leo Sen anyway? What's the deal with him?
Yeah. Oh, I was just so fascinated with this phenomenon in creativity where you can fall in love with another person platonically through their brain, right? I mean, like,
sure.
If every time we read a book and we love the book and it's a book that we think about a lot and we come back to a lot, you've fallen in love a little bit with sort of some essential part of the writer's soul. And I think that is one of the most beautiful things ever, which means that there's a little piece of me that's deeply in love with George Eliot, right? Or with Henry James, even though they've been dead for years and years and years and years. I mean, they still live through my, like, passionate adoration of certain books of theirs. And so I love that idea, and I love that Lotto is a person who just falls in love with, you know, the other person's ideas and brains and concepts without really analyzing what it is that's happening.
It's funny.
And, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, David Mitchell, who wrote Cloud Atlas and The Thousand Summers of and The Bone
right.
Clocks, and now he's written this new book called Slade House, and I'm interviewing him day after tomorrow. He's the kind of author that I kind of fell in love with. Not that I'm not in love with you.
No, I am deeply in love with David Mitchell. No, I think he is absolutely ridiculously awesome, especially Black Swan Green. And
oh, yeah,
God
I love
Atlas.
That book.
Oh, my God.
Slade House starts out a little bit like, I just have the arc, but it starts out a little bit like that. It's not going to be released for a month or so, but it starts out a little bit like Black Swan Green with the kid. But, and when I interviewed him, he's such a nice, gentle person who never leaves Ireland, and that's where he is, and that's where he's going to talk to me from. And he just is such a nice, nice person. And he writes this. When you read his books, it's like reading a really beautiful painting on the wall of a museum.
Right.
You just want to stay there.
I agree. I absolutely agree. You know, this is so funny. This past weekend at Texas Book Festival, I met Jeff Dyer.
Uh-huh.
And it was such a strange experience because there he was standing in front of me. He's very handsome, and he's, you know, charming and sweet and everything. But I was a little bit, there was a part of me that resisted meeting him because I love his book so much, right? It was just one of those things where, like, the physical person was not the person necessarily that I was fascinated by.
Yeah, I know what you mean. But yeah. I did, this summer, I went to this, there's this author's night in the Hamptons that Alec Baldwin started, and I took Christina Baker Klein and Bill's client who wrote We Are Not Ourselves.
Matthew Thomas.
Yeah, Matt Thomas. And he's the nicest guy in the world, and she's just hilarious. So I spent like a couple nights out with them drinking and stuff like that. I had the greatest time. They were both so nice. And she came to the bookstore and did a signing and all. But you're right, though. It's like, before I talk to you, both in Arcadia and in this book, and I wish everyone could talk to you, but I mean, I now have a completely different, it's a feel for the book. I still feel about it the same way, but it really helps to talk to the person, I think.
I think you're right. I think sometimes it does, yeah. Yeah.
But, no one gets to do that. Well, so anyway, we were talking about Charlie. What about some of the other friends that you populate the book with? Because even if they only have just a few lines, you can remember what they've done or what they stand for. How did you find all those different characters? Because there's a bunch of them.
Well, I was, you know, having been out of college for the past 15 years, I'm sort of fascinated by this phenomenon where you think that you're great friends with a huge, large group of people, and slowly, year after year, people wander away into their own lives, which is the way it should be, right? But it's still a little bit sad to remember, you know, those parties back when you were young.
Yeah, it's like the big, the big chill.
Yeah, like the big chill, exactly. Right, exactly. There's this, in the book, I think it's the third chapter, is told through parties in one specific place. It's sort of like a play where the years go by one after the other, and we only see Lotto and Mathilde change through these specific scenes within where they have party after party. And I thought it was interesting to sort of watch the winnowing of people from this huge group to this very tight and loving and somewhat difficult group from the beginning to the end of these 9 years that take place in this little Greenwich Village apartment.
And it's funny how, you know, whether it's Samuel or whoever you can think of.
Danica or
Danica, yes. And they, you know, like, they're kids and they go to college and then they become investment bankers they go to an internet startup. And it's like, wait a minute, they were just in college.
Right.
And that's what happens to everybody. Except for authors, you can play. You can keep playing.
Yeah. I mean, you can get sort of calcified in being a writer also.
Someone was saying that, you know, the pursuit of your dream. We were talking about the National Book Award, actually, because I was reading what you get. You get $10,000 and a bronze statue, but you could do better than that on Jeopardy. So, and it should be like a silver, like the Olympics, like with your sister, it should be like a silver or a gold.
And but she got fourth, so she didn't get anything.
True.
So, you know.
Well, yeah, but you got $1,000 and a little bronze medallion, I think.
Yeah, I know, right? But I would love to have that bronze medallion, you know, $1,000. That's you know, that's a really, really, really good couple of dinners in New York City.
Yeah. So, I did buy it at a silent auction last week. I bought a dinner at Le Cirque, so I'm looking forward to that.
Ooh, yeah. Nicely done.
I know. When I'm talking about all these characters that are involved and how they have different feelings for both Lotto and Mathilde, were you trying to, like, it's almost like a Greek chorus, isn't it?
It is a Greek chorus, yeah. I'm also trying to cast doubt on sort of the definite aspect of the story being told, right?
Yeah.
And this is what we've been talking about basically the entire way through our conversation, right? Because that's not the way that I see life working. I mean, nobody has a uniform idea of friends in the same social group. Everybody has a slightly different or massively different idea of other people. And I find that's much more rich and more interesting than the single story told over and over again.
That's funny, because I've kind of been fighting with you. You've been drawing me into this, because at the beginning of this conversation and in the book, I was fighting against the concept of I had an idea of what was going on. And when someone would come up and say, no, she's so plain, it got me confused. And she's beautiful. She's absolutely stunningly beautiful. And then just like with Antoinette, she was absolutely gorgeous, so gorgeous when she was a mermaid.
Right.
And then she turns into something like Ursula in Little Mermaid.
Right, right. She becomes Ursula. I know, exactly.
Hey, that was a pretty good one.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's a whole book unto itself.
It is. I had a lot of fun with that. And just, you know, for the record, my mother-in-law is awesome. nothing to do with the internet.
I didn't even think about that.
She's a tremendously good human being. And she is not, you know, agoraphobic in her own little house. And, she's good.
Well, it's funny because, you know, what does Mathilde say? She goes, oh, so our relationship's going to be like every other daughter-in-law, mother-in-law relationship.
Right, right. Oh, great. Now we're playing the cliche all over again.
Sorry.
She's not a person who likes the cliches in life.
So has your mother-in-law read it? Does she like it?
She has read it. I don't know if she likes it, but she's read it, and she's very supportive.
And then the other thing is, you know, the people in the book are not necessarily good or bad, but
right.
I have my I'm entitled, like you said.
You are absolutely entitled.
to have my own opinion about it. But I don't think you could argue that Sally and Rachel are just purely good, right?
I think on the spectrum, they are the most purely good, but I would agree that they're not only purely good.
But they are. I mean, and Rachel is. I mean, Rachel is very nice, and Sally is very generous.
Yeah, but I mean, nobody's purely good. I mean, even saints are awful human beings to live with.
That's
right?
Why they. Yeah, that's why they get martyred.
That's why they. That's why they get martyred.
That's what I said.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. No, I mean, nobody's pure, and that's the way it should be. And this idea that people are only good is a destructive idea.
Yeah, well, and I think that's, I mean, that's, I think you've explained, like I said before, I haven't asked you any questions that go to the specifics of the book, so I've been really good as a interviewer or a reviewer, because you said a lot of the reviews you feel give away way too much of the book, which I think so too.
Well, I haven't read them, but I would say a lot of them probably have. Okay, all right.
But so I haven't gone anywhere near there. But what's cool is I think your answers really do kind of comprehensively explain the book.
Thank you.
Don't you think?
You know, I've been working on it. I don't know. that's what this process of book tour is. It's slowly whittling down your ideas about your own book that you wrote that was, you know, before the book tour, just a complete mystery to you.
Well, so you'll have to sharpen all this to a point before Seth Meyers, because you're going to get like 7 minutes and you don't want to give anything away.
I know. I don't know. What do I do? You're right.
You can do it. You're a writer.
Oh, God. All right. Thank you.
Well, with that, I've just loved talking to you again, and it's a great book, and just so happy for you and all your success, and I would love to see you sometime when I come to Gainesville and you're there.
That would be fun.
That'd be fun.
Great. We'll go get coffee.
I would love to.
Me too.
That was Lauren Groff, who's from my semi-hometown of Gainesville, Florida. I went to the University of Florida and law school there too. And so a lot of the context of the book is known to me before, probably not to you, simply because I'm familiar with the places and the names and a lot of the things that happened there. And I was like kind of off my rocker because couldn't really say anything because the book is written in such a way that any recitation of any factual incident in the book is going to give away something. It's like when M. Night Shyamalan did The Sixth Sense. The reviewers were so kind because no one actually gave away the fact that he was dead in the reviews, which I was amazed at. How could everyone be so kind as to not give it away? Because if one person gave it away, that would have been the end of the movie. Anyway, so what do we have going on? I have my notes here. But anyway, so it's coming up on Christmas time. So once again, my loyal, prompt, and courteous store manager, Donna McFadden, and I will have our Christmas show where we basically yell at each other. But the concept of the show, other than the yelling, which will be there, is, best books of 2015. We usually are generally in agreement about most of these, but we both bring our own books to the table, literally and figuratively, and it's always fun talking to her about those books, and I think it'll give you some insights into maybe what you want to read or what you want to buy for your father, your grandfather, your son, your nephew, your grandson, whatever, because we will run the gamut between kids' books, young adult books, teen books, science fiction books, history, mystery, historical fiction. So that, you know, and what other thing can you give somebody for Christmas or any present that's better than giving them a book? Because it's like giving them a whole world. Not to get all romantic about it, but it is. And like Lauren said, you know, it's like you fall in love with an author. And I was saying about David Mitchell, the writing is so beautiful. It's like you never unwrap the present because you're always looking. You know, you're always so happy that you got it. Man, I'm really weird today. Anyway, so other things coming up is David Mitchell, that author that I talked about. He's coming to discuss Slade House, which is also a National Book Award finalist. And Mary Gateskill will join us to discuss The Mare, talk about the book The Mare, which is really good. And I can't believe Isabel Allende is coming to talk to me. I have to be much more sane in my conversation with her for her latest work, The Japanese Lover. So I have to work on that. So for a complete schedule of everything and the past 250 authors who have been willing to speak with me after today, I don't know, go to wellingtonsquarebooks.com or WCHE1520.com or just simply now you just press the podcast button on iTunes or download the podcast app and download our podcast one at a time. Or if you want to be in some kind of Dantean hell for the rest of your life, you could download all 250 hours of me doing this. So anyway, thanks as always, and we will see you, or you will listen to me and my author next week on The Avid Reader.